G'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truthtoyou.org. That's truth number two, letter U.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Jason, Spiritual Babies of spiritualbabies.net. G'day, mate.
Good evening, Jono. We're in a time warp this evening.
We're in a time warp because this not only is there the international dateline, which is always difficult to juggle when, you know, one of us is in Australia, one's in Ireland, one's in, I don't even know where, at the moment he's in Israel. And of course, we're talking about Rabbi Tobias Singer, my friend. Thank you for coming back on the program.
Hey, great to be here.
OutreachJudaism.org is his website, but the time, not only are we juggling the international dateline, but times are changing. What happened over there in Israel on the Thursday?
They've been sort of in Israel, they vote on when sometimes in the Knesset, when to change the time. They've taken to account, you know, fast days and making fast days a little bit easier. So they actually changed the time in Israel Thursday night, and people are going, who listening to this are like scratching their going, Thursday night? Like, what's that? You know, like, I'm in the middle of watching the Ed Sullivan Show. How did that happen? And for those of you too young, this show's not for you. I'm kidding. So, but, you know, in Israel, the day that's sort of a partial day sort of is really Friday because people are getting ready for Shabbos. So Sunday in the land of Israel is like a Tuesday. It's a full work day. But Friday is a work day, but people are preparing for Shabbos, leaving early. So therefore, the evening that they thought of really would work well, it would interfere least, would be a Thursday night. And in Ireland, they try to figure out when people are drunk, and they do it, I think, on a Saturday night, 3 a.m. But, you know, it depends on the culture.
You've gone into daylight saving times. I think you already have as well, haven't you, Jason?
Yeah, it just happened this weekend.
And it's about to happen here, or revert back, of course, in the Southern Hemisphere this weekend. Anyway, we figured it all out, and we are here just a little bit earlier for Jason and I than we expected, but it's all right. What we're talking about and what we're very excited to be doing, of course, it is that time of the year. It's Pesach. We're coming up to Pesach, right? Very exciting. And what we wanted to ask you about, Tobias, what we wanted to discuss is maybe something that people don't often get to consider, and that is during the Exodus or the lead up to the Exodus, what was going through the Egyptians' mind? And what I mean by that is not just all the plagues. I mean, let's get past the plagues, but they slaughter a lamb, the Hebrews do. They put the blood over the doorposts. They eat the lamb. They've got all these things outlined in Exodus chapter 12. And there are some Egyptians, I would imagine, after all of these plagues, thinking, you know what? I reckon we're back the wrong horse here. I think we're on the losing team. I think maybe I should join with the Israelites because, you know, their God, he's pretty serious stuff. And I mean, Egypt has been destroyed. It's lying in ruin. And I don't know if I want to stick around any longer because it may be the demise of us all. And they would be weighing this up and talking about this with their partner, with their children and their neighbors. What are we to do here? Some of them, I believe, would, because it talks about that a mixed multitude left in the Exodus with the Israelites. So have we ever stopped to think what went through their mind and what was at stake, Tobias?
Yeah, they should have anticipated that Egypt would have been destroyed. And in fact, from the Exodus took place in the year 2448 after creation. So we're talking about a little over 3,300 years ago. From about 3,300 years ago till about 2,900 years ago, there's sort of a blank where we, in fact, don't hear anything from Egypt because obviously we have a society that had been shattered. God, however, does something that he's going to do in the future in Gog and Magog, and that is he's going to have the leader of Egypt, and this is not a democratic society, but he's going to have the leader of Egypt do something that is absolutely preposterous in enduring these plagues, watching Egypt being destroyed. And this continues to go on as the Jews leave the land of Egypt and come to the Red Sea. And that is, they're going to act in a way that makes no sense. That's completely irrational. And in fact, the Bible tells us in Exodus chapter 4, verse 27, that God had intervened here. and that is that he had hardened the heart of the Egyptians, specifically Lev Paro, the heart of Pharaoh. And that is, so at this juncture, once Pharaoh is acting in a way that's wicked, God then takes away from him, he removes from his free will. And now Pharaoh is acting essentially as God's puppet. He is now acting in a way that is irrational, that would make no sense whatsoever, because Egypt is being destroyed. The God of Israel is showing his power, his might. And in every aspect, you know, in the ancient world, there were different gods, because they really genuinely, the ancients genuinely believed that what is in the air, what is in the ground, what is in the water, they're totally different. They don't know what we know today. So therefore, the plagues are also divided. The plagues are coming from the air. They're coming in the water. They're coming from the ground. So therefore, there's a demonstration that there is one God who is controlling every force, and then finally culminating with the death of the firstborn in Egypt. So there's a hardening of the heart, and if you're not sure what is happening, you can watch how Iran is behaving today and how the enemies of Israel are behaving today. It doesn't really make sense when you think about it. What is Iran bothering? But in fact, they're acting in a reckless way, because in fact, God, his name has to be raised up, and that's Ezekiel 38 and 39. So if you're not sure, what I'm doing with the audience is doing what the Bible does. Frequently, Scripture will say, if you want to know what that's going to be like, look back at this event in the past. So if you want to get a sense, you who are listening to this broadcast, of how irrationally the Egyptians are behaving, you can see how the world's behaving. Iran doesn't even have a border with Israel, yet they are preparing to go to war with the Jewish state. And of course, it will be destroyed. You know, Zechariah 8 and 12 will be fulfilled. That's what's happening here. And the Jewish people would have to demonstrate by what they did that they would be privileged to be a part of a royal nation. That's what the book of Exodus is. That's where the Passover comes into view. Genesis is forming that royal family. The book of Exodus, if you want to sum it up, is really the formation of the nation of Israel.
Sure. And so now you mentioned the different plagues coming from the sky, coming from the water, coming from the ground, and to demonstrate, of course, because in the Egyptian religious world, a polytheistic society, a whole number of gods that the Egyptians worshipped, this shows the sovereignty and the almighty power of God, the nine plagues preceding this one. This one also does the same thing. Can I say that? Because there was a ram god, is that right?
Yeah. There was a god of the Egyptians, and that they worshipped it. In fact, in Egypt, it was not a tolerant society. It wasn't, if you killed one of their gods, I mean, like, I believe in India today, I think, you know, because it's a, although it's the largest, second largest Islamic population in the world, it is a Hindu society. I think, I'm not sure, I think if you injure a cow, which is worshipped in Hinduism or seen as a deity. In Egypt, it wasn't. India is a democracy. Egypt, it was, of course, in the ancient world that this was inconceivable. And therefore, the lamb was a god to the Egyptians. And if you harmed it, if you did it, if you killed it, if you slaughtered it, if you were caught, you were killed. You were put to death for that. That was a capital offense in the ancient Egyptian world, and as a result, we see that interaction following the plague of lice, where Pharaoh says is trying to work this through with Moses, and he's saying to Moses, like, Moses is saying, we have to bring our sacrifice to God, and therefore we have to leave here and go. We have to leave this place, and Pharaoh is turning to him and saying, well, you don't really have to do that. You can offer...
Do it here.
Do it right here. You know, we'll, you know, let you do it right where we are right now. And so there's a critical passage, and that's in Exodus chapter 8, verse 26, where Moses said, we can't do that because what we're going to sacrifice is the abomination of the Egyptians. He's being very forward. And he's saying, and therefore, and if we did that... you're gonna try to kill him. You know, this would have been a capital offense. This brings into view now what is really going on with God testing the Jewish people in a way that God had tested Abraham, in that the Jewish people were asked, you know, for Passover, a number of very important things to do. But one of the things was take the God of the Egyptians, I mean, take this lamb, and on the 10th day you tie it down, and then what you do is you slaughter it. And you don't do it in your basement because we want the blood to be on the outside of the doorpost. So therefore, this was a public display. You have to demonstrate that your fear of God exceeds that of your fear of the Egyptian army. And it was those Jews who demonstrated that, yeah.
So just going back to Genesis, we understand during the time of Joseph, he says, look, just tell Pharaoh that you guys are your keepers of sheep, your herdsmen, and they'll tell you, well, you go and do that somewhere else because, you know, that is an abomination in our sight. Now, is that the same reason? It's an abomination for that reason?
Yeah, that these were gods who were widely worshipped. We're very aware of a whole wide range of gods in the ancient Egyptian world that were perceived as deities, including Amon-Ra, you know. So therefore this, they were asking Amon-Ra, they were asking saying to the Egyptians, we're not bringing it here. Here you worship this as a god. We don't want to slaughter here. We're going to do it somewhere else. And this was a test of the Jewish people. Would they demonstrate their faith in God by be willing to do, which was a capital offense in Egypt, yeah.
And so it's serious stuff. And so obviously, Amun-Ra, now that's probably the most prominent ram god of the Egyptians. There are a number of other ones, but Amun-Ra is certainly the most well-known and widely worshipped at the time. And in the Exodus, or in chapter 12, as you point out, Tobia, what we were to do is to tie the lamb or the goat, the kid, tie it up for 10 days and basically have it on display. Now I want to go to the Egyptian and the neighboring Egyptian, Tobia. What's going through their head? They're looking over there. They're peering over there at the Israelites, and they see they've got a kid tied up. What would be going through their head? What are they doing with this? Why is this in the yard? Why is it tied up? Surely they're not going to do what we perceive they might be going to do. I mean, what is this, something that God has told them to do? I mean, all these thoughts would have been going through their head.
Yeah. And
it's on display for 4 days, right?
Yeah. There is, in a sense, you know, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. They, the Egyptians, could have asked questions, just as I'm sure Noah taking more than a century to build an ark in the middle of land, which would be like in the United States building it in an ark somewhere in Ohio in the middle of, you know, what are you doing with it? People could have asked the question. They didn't. And ultimately, we see that the Egyptians would use their cattle that were not injured during the plague against their cattle. Mm-hmm. They would use that to chase down the Jews and where they would confront them at the front of the Red Sea. So the Egyptians had failed completely, even the best of the Egyptians. A very intriguing piece here, because the Egyptians eventually are going to run after the Jewish people after they leave, which again makes no sense at all. Here we have, they've been delivered 10 plagues for 11 months straight. You'd think at that point they would get it, like just let them go, but they're not, and they're running down with all these horses and chariots. And the question is, where did they get the horses from? Wouldn't those horses have been killed in the plague against their animals? But in fact, the Egyptians, who kept their animals indoors and didn't allow them out, those animals were not affected. So it's interesting, just addressing your question in a very sharp way, that what we now can see is even those Egyptians who were a little nervous about Moses and very concerned enough to keep their animals indoors, when it came down to it, they ultimately, everyone's heart is hardened, and they're going after the Jewish people. And of course, all the Egyptian army is going to be destroyed in an unprecedented event in human history.
I find it interesting that the sign, if you like, of obedience in this is to not just take this animal, which represents this kind of foreign pagan god, the lamb of the Egyptians, or the goat of the Egyptians. That's not enough. And it's not enough that they have to keep this in their house for 4 days. And it's not even enough that they have to eat it. They have to take the animal and roast it, because you're not allowed to boil the meat, which that would have bloated and changed the look of the meat. They're not allowed to break the animal up. They have to be completely aware of the animal that they're eating. And the animal that remains would keep the look of the animal that was in life, you know, the shape of it. So there couldn't be, you know, if an Egyptian slave or one of the other nations of slaves came around and said, look, you know, we heard there's something going on tonight, we want to take part, they wouldn't have just been given a drumstick. they'd have had to say, man, they're eating a lamb. If we get caught, we are.
Now this is really, yeah. Now you mentioned, you know, there's something going down tonight. Can we be in on this, because we realize that your god is more powerful than our gods? Because here is the Israelites community. They've got their lambs on display, you know, tied up to the house. Here it is, 4 days, and they start talking to each other. Toby, tell me if you think this is fair. They start talking to it. They start asking questions. Oh, well, this is what Moses said. This is what God has said to Moses. And they've gone, but what does that mean for my firstborn? What are you telling me that God's going to kill my? Can I do this as well? Now the question is, would they have participated in some sort of Passover lamb, or would they have joined with the Israelite community in their Passover? What would have happened, Tobia?
Yeah, well, it was forbidden. It means the Torah does outline in these same texts that, in fact, no non-Jew could take part in the Passover lamb. That was just so listeners know, non-Jews could bring sacrifices in the temple. And we see, in fact, in the future temple, in the very last verse of Zechariah, the kings of nations will, in fact, bring sacrifices, but not the Passover lamb. That was only for someone who was a Jew, who was circumcised. So they could not take part in this. This was a last moment. Everything, also, it's important to bear in mind that everything is happening very quickly. And there's an emphasis on speed that's going to be going on out here as well. That means this is all happening in the blink of an eye. And just to know that we're not reading anything into the text, one of the, a very, I think, a strange commandment, I think that is very striking, that another thing that we're supposed to eat is matzah on Passover, because matzah is so prominent, and one has to ask the question, and this, I think, addresses the issue you're raising. I mean, what is essentially matzah? The Jews left with such speed, so the bread, the dough didn't have time to rise. It wasn't possible. Mm-hmm. Now, frankly, if I were going to come up with a ritual that would encapsulate and convey an excess, a redemption, would I be saying, would I be using the fast food? That's really what it is.
Right.
It's all right, but fast food, all right, I don't think that. What is happening there? So there's enormous, scripture is telling us that there was enormous speed, that this all had to happen very, very fast at the very, very end. And in fact, we know this in Exodus 12, because Hashem says, God says that, in fact, I had to take you out. There was no longer any time left. Time had run out. So this is going to all happen with speed. This is happening very rapidly. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's one other point that should be placed here. God, in a sense, was looking at his clock and realized, in a sense, I'm using this, in a sense, realized, because we have free will, so God. What's happening is that he couldn't wait the 430 years that was originally promised to Abraham, that the Jews would be in Egypt. Couldn't. The Jewish people had to be redeemed much faster. There was no time. Time had run out. I don't know if we want to cover it in the show, but time had run out because the Jewish people had fallen very far, far, far down. So instead of the 430 years or 400 years, the Jewish people were only in Egypt as slaves for 210 years. a much shorter period of time. And we could see this clearly in just how many generations.
I'm confused because I'm looking at Exodus chapter 12, verse 40. It says, "Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of Jehovah went out from the land of Egypt."
Right. So this creates an enormous conundrum because it couldn't be 430 years. You can just simply move it this way. If you take Levi, who was the son of Jacob, who would have been coming into the land of Egypt, and then you have Levi, and who was his son? His son would have been Kehath. His son would have been Amram, and Amram was the father of Moses. You couldn't have 430 years in those four generations. So therefore, what God does here and is to actually backtrack the numbers, because the time had run out. There was no more time. And start counting from the birth of Isaac. This point, incidentally, was very well known to the first Christians. Just this is an aside which most people miss. And that is that in Galatians 3, is an aside, when Paul is addressing the Galatians and making a point that I find obviously very objectionable, where he's going to say, well, if we look at the time when God made the covenant with Abraham, until the time that the Jewish people went out of Egypt and the Torah was given at Mount Sinai, that entire period is 430 years. That's perfect, because you have 210 years from the covenant with Abraham until the Jews go down to Egypt, and 220, and then you have 210 for the time the Jews were in Egypt. It's very interesting to watch all the Christian commentators trying to make sense out of Galatians 3:17. Paul is trying to make a point, which is really not germane to what we're discussing here. So what's happening is that it's interrupted. And if you look carefully at Exodus 12, you'll see that there was no longer any time. Well, what do you mean there was no longer any time? What was haste? If it was exactly 430 years, meaning that they were enslaved, then what's speed? It's 430 years. What is this language that we have to get out? You know, we have to get out the Jews very quickly. So because they were driven out, there was no longer any time to wait. They had run out of time. Mm. And so therefore we have
the matzah.
Therefore we have the matzah. And the matzah indicates to us that in fact God redeemed the Jews at the very last second. That in fact, if the Jews had remained in Egypt any longer, they would have assimilated too far into the Egyptian society. They would have adopted their mores and
lost their identity.
It would have been unredeemable.
Let me ask Jason. I mean, just this is something that I need to then study up on and check the passages, the relevant passages. I've always understood that this 430 years would have been from the time that Joseph landed in Egypt, followed by the remainder of his family. Jason, how traditionally have you always understood this 430 years?
The same way.
Same way? Yeah.
Yeah. But that said, my understanding of this comes from my heritage and my background. And, you know, I'm always open to new ideas.
Yes, always so, open to new ideas. So that's new. So there's something to look at. Would be interested in the listeners' comments in regards to that. Moving on, though, just past the 430 years, you mentioned that no foreigner, only Israelites could take part in the Passover. And I just want to read that because that's from verse 43 on of Exodus chapter 12, and it says that Jehovah said to Moses and Aaron, "This is the ordinance of the Passover, for no foreigner shall eat it." No foreigner shall eat it. "But every man's servant who is bought for money, when you have circumcised him, then he may eat it. A sojourner and a hired servant shall not eat it. In one house it shall be eaten, and you shall not carry any of the flesh outside the house, nor shall you break one of its bones." Shall not break one of its bones. "All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And when a stranger dwells with you, when a stranger dwells with you and wants to keep the Passover to Jehovah, let all his males be circumcised and let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as a native of the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat it. One law shall be for the native-born and for the stranger who dwells among you. So the question becomes, Tobia, is it possible that an Egyptian saw the writing on the wall, so to speak, and said, please let me be part of this. I value my son's life. And they say, well, is it possible they would have said, well, you need to be circumcised, and you need to be with us in the house. Could that have happened?
Yeah, and that's where we see the mixed multitude, the Erev, which is are those who would have been caught up, swept up in this, observing this spectacle, would have joined the Jewish people in some way. And that means they're not part of the family of Israel. They're not descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's critical. And they would have become part of that mixed multitude.
I'm just thinking about this. It would have been a very, very public thing. You know, the neighbor of the Egyptian who was chosen to go to the Israelites and plead with them and say, can I take part in this ritual with you? And they say, yes, but you must be circumcised. Now, it's you can't really hide the fact that you've been circumcised. I mean, you're obviously in some serious discomfort for a number of days. Your neighbors know what's going on. Surely the Egyptian who takes part in this is thinking, boy, I tell you what, I hope I've backed the right horse, because if this doesn't happen like it's supposed to happen, I'm going to be outcast. I'm going to be shunned, if not killed, by my neighbors and by the governing body of the day. There's no hiding what I have done here. It's not as if I can hide my circumcision. It's not as if I can hide the fact that I have publicly taken part in this ritual that the Israelites are about to go through, and they are going to spray the blood of this lamb over the threshold, and I'm going to pass in through that. There's no turning back once I do this.
Yeah. I hope that the listener notices that every aspect of Passover is an event that not only the Jewish people, but that whole entire world sees. The Jews and it's very much on display. Everyone can see it. In contrast, if you look at the other holidays and belief systems of other religions, those things that are celebrated, they weren't there for everyone to see. You either believe it or don't believe it. These are national events that are taking place in the open. What is clear is everybody is being tested. At some point, Pharaoh loses his free will. His heart is hardened in order to display the strength of the God of Israel so that all may know it. Egyptians are watching this. There's some of them are trying to get themselves into line. You could see that because there's animal left over. You could see it because they'll enter into a mixed multitude. Scripture is not very interested in that aspect. The scripture is devoted to demonstrating that these Jews were the ones who were willing to take that risk. No doubt there were many other Jews who were not willing to take that risk and, of course, suffered and never left Egypt and never were able to be a part of the nation of Israel.
That's an untold story right there. We never really give that much much thought. But, man, imagine being that house. That would be terrifying.
Yeah. Isn't there a parallel to today? That means that we're living in a time when the nations are gathering against Israel. Every day in the UN, they're passing another resolution condemning Israel while there's a slaughter going on in Syria all over. Mm-hmm. Are there Arabs who are waking up and are seeing and saying, do they have to go against a very strong culture that's telling them no? This is Israel or Palestine is part of a caliphate, and they do. Are there some that have turned to the God of Israel? Yes, there are, but you could see the momentum of that culture and that thinking, that hardening of the heart of the enemy. So we see. Remember that this is not just history, but it's going to be repeated again, and it's going to be paralleled with the Messianic age. That in fact, the enemies of Israel consistently behave badly. There are a few individuals who have come on board, but there are Jews who have behaved terribly as well, both in the past and today as well. So that parallelism is going on without pause.
Mm. Jason, you were going to say.
I was going to say there are going to be a lot of people who are looking at Passover and remembering Easter, if you like. And it just occurred to me the kind of irony that at the first Passover, the Son of God, from Exodus 4:22, lived and survived. And that irony there is kind of, it blew me away a little bit. I hadn't really thought about that before. I know a lot of people on my friends page on Facebook are going to be looking forward to Passover as a time where they were spiritually redeemed. And I'm thinking, how much cooler to be like physically set free.
Sure. Because Pharaoh would have, it was considered a demigod, right? This is, Tovia, is that right? Pharaoh was considered a son of the gods. And in this case, Amun-Ra, the ram god that they worshipped, and they would have acknowledged Pharaoh as a son of that god. Have I got that right?
Yeah, and all these gods are always associated with the sun. Everything is all, and of course Christianity would in a sense do the same. But the sun was very, very important and was connected to this. And the only other major god, there were many other gods in Egypt, but the other one was Osiris, which again you have that similarity and parallelism in ancient Egypt.
But what Jason's referring to, obviously, is Exodus chapter 4, verse 22. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says Yehovah, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. But if you refuse to let him go, indeed, I will kill your son, your firstborn. And that's the reference there. But of course, when God refers to Israel as his son, his firstborn, it's not referring to the nation as a nation of demigods, right? It's a different concept again.
No, yeah, but remember, the ancients were not idiots, meaning the way they understood, and this is true we could see this transition happening in early Christianity. In the ancient world, they believed that there was some sort of major god who kind of ran the world. And then there were these enormously powerful people who to them clearly couldn't possibly have just been human. The emperors, certainly the pharaohs. So therefore they had to in some way have been conceived in some miraculous way and having with them basically sort of these are God men, not equal to the absolute sun, but these were a part of this whole body. And, you know, and what Jason's pointing out is intriguing. Easter is a holiday that we'll see in the church in the second century. It's not mentioned in the Christian canon itself. But what they're doing is they're saying they're celebrating the fact that Jesus rose from the dead. But the Jews who in fact kept the Passover didn't die. It's exactly the reverse. That's I think Jason's point, and it's brilliant. And that is, and Jason's going, well,
yes, thank you very much.
Jason's going, yeah, well, that wasn't like actually that my segment. Point, but if he said it's brilliant, I'll go with it.
I'd like that 30 seconds just for me. You can send that on.
Yeah, so I mean, it's everything is reversed from the Christian notion of Passover, in that it was in fact the people who participated in the Passover lived. They didn't have, there was no death. In the New Testament, in the Synoptic Gospels, means that of Mark, Matthew, and Luke, Jesus is not a lamb, but we have is in the, by the book of John, which would have been chronologically the last book of the Gospels to be written, we're already introduced to Jesus differently. Jesus is not baptized in the book of John, but John the Baptist, when he sees Jesus, calls him in John 1:36, and I think in 1:29 as well, that Jesus is, behold, the Lamb of God. So the Lamb there, in John's thinking, is, to that community, is in fact Jesus, and Jesus becomes personified. The consequences are going to be staggering for the book of John, because if John wants to have Jesus as the Lamb, which means in some way he's a fulfillment of this Lamb, so Jesus would not be crucified on the first day of Passover as Matthew, Mark, and Luke have him crucified. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because remember, if the Last Supper is a Passover Seder, if this is confusing, let's make this simple. If the Last Supper is a Passover Seder, which it is in the Synoptic Gospels, mm-hmm. that means, and the Last Supper takes place for all the Hasidim, Hasidic Jews listen to this, just so you know. The Last Supper takes place the night before all the Christians, of course, I knew that. Anyway, but for all the Lubavitchers listening to the show. So that would be, the Last Supper would have takes place the night before Jesus crucified. So in the synoptics, Jesus crucified on the 15th day of Nisan or the first day of Passover. John wants Jesus to be the Passover lamb eaten at the Passover in the sense that is killed, is crucified on the eve of Passover. So therefore, John is going to have Jesus crucified on the 14th day of Nisan. And therefore, if you look at John's Last Supper, there's a dinner, but it isn't the Last Supper. Jesus is washing the feet of the disciples in John 13. It's very, very different. Only in John we have a whole series of it's on the eve of Passover. The Jews will not go into the home of Pontius Pilate because they're afraid of being defiled, lest they won't be able to eat the Passover. Well, according to the synoptics, they would have nothing to be concerned about because they already had it yesterday. So the consequences are going to be enormous. John is always going to be the favorite gospel for the church. And therefore, its impact is the church eventually is going to assign Easter to the 14th day of Nisan, going by John, going according to John's, the way John presents it. And this is going to be a major war, a major schism in the church of precisely when should Easter be celebrated. But that's the second century, and everything opposes, because if you think about a Passover, the Jews who, in fact, passed this test did what Paul would say is impossible, what Romans 3 would indicate cannot happen. So therefore, in Romans chapter 3, what we're finding, the book of Romans, for those not familiar, is like the constitution of Christianity. That's where a great deal of Christian theology comes from, not from the Gospels. We're told, with a conflation of many different passages sort of put together, that no one can serve God. No works, no one can be saved by what they're doing. This has become a very important part of Christian thinking. In fact, that's exactly the reverse of what happened on the Passover. People, I mean, imagine the kind of fear of God the Jew had to have at that time, because they had to defy an army that they could see. The Egyptian soldiers, I would imagine, would be everywhere for anyone to notice, especially during a time when there was enormous upheaval. They had to say that my fear of God, the God of Israel, exceeds that of we mentioned, of the Egyptian army. So that means they accomplished what Paul said, what the church would say is absolutely impossible. And that is that they did something. It was by their obedience to God that they were saved, not by anyone dying for their sins. It should be also noted, and this will come as a surprise, it strikes me as odd, I was surprised by this, but I think that many Christians think that the Passover lamb was somehow an atonement for sin. There's no relationship between, there's no mention of sin with regard to the Passover lamb.
It's not a sin sacrifice, right? It's not a sin sacrifice.
Not at all. It was a sacrifice. I mean, now if we could assemble all this information, it's not only not a sin sacrifice, it's a righteous sacrifice, meaning it's a sacrifice that demonstrated that you were faithful and obedient and righteous. It's an unbelievable thing. That means if you were sinning, you couldn't bring the lamb, and you wouldn't bring the lamb, and you wouldn't be saved. It is a righteous sacrifice. Only righteous people could bring it, because only righteous people would ever do this. Mm-hmm. Only a righteous person would ever risk their lives because of what the God of Israel had declared. So therefore, it's not only not a sin sacrifice, it's the opposite of a sin sacrifice. It's a sacrifice that illustrates, demonstrates conclusively that this person is filled with trust in God, not by some faith, which means that they just believe, but by their actions, by how they behaved, exactly what Abraham was called on to do. Mm-hmm. It means we have this language of Abraham had faith and if he was counted as righteous, but one has to look that God is testing Abraham repeatedly, and in 26 verse 5 of Genesis, we are told that in fact it is because Abraham kept all the commands, he therefore illustrated that he trusted in God, not because Abraham said, yeah, I have faith in you, but he actually did it, and therefore he was given the covenant. What he did in Christian theology, what Abraham did would have been theologically impossible.
Very good point. Jason?
It must have been horrible to have generation after generation after generation within the boundaries of that civilization. But at least they had a house and they had food And that there must have been a point that where they said, you know, where are we going to go? There's no one's mentioned a plan here. All we know is that something's happening tonight. And I think that to exercise that faith in those numbers is astounding. And how awesome it would be to have just a handful of people that would be like that today. That would be amazing.
Oh, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it though? And that's a very good point. And so, and just to reiterate, it was such, for both the Egyptian and the Israelite, such a public display from which there was no return, an enormous amount of faith to step into and do what it is that God told Moses to convey to the Israelites. They did it. They were obedient. They were righteous. And but again, boy, I tell you what, particularly for the Egyptian, you would have been very, very nervous in taking part in the Passover. And yet so many of them did, and all the Israelites did, a very, very public display from which there is no return.
Yeah, and confronted again today. It means this will happen throughout history. In fact, we see, if you look carefully, that the Bible tells us that although the covenant given to the Jewish people is eternal, nothing could happen, nothing could change that. However, no individual Jew has that guarantee. And we see that in Deuteronomy chapter 7, it's only those who are obedient to my commandments and love me, they are the ones who will be given the covenant. We'll see that in Deuteronomy 7, verse 9, and again verse 12. And if you look at the Jewish people today, who are they? You know, think about this for a moment. Throughout the last couple thousand years, many Jews had become Christians, become Muslims, atheists, joined all their grandchildren not here with us. You will encounter... You, the listener, will encounter many Jewish people who are not observant, who are not. Mm. But if you ask them, you know, go back 5-6 generations ago, what were they? They would tell you they were observant Jews. Mm. They were Jews who abandoned the fundamental principles of the Jewish faith. They're gone. Where are the descendants of Peter? They're not here with us today. Why not? Why didn't God preserve those Jews who believed in Jesus? After all, they were doing the right thing. Why was it only those Jews who specifically rejected the tenets of every religion? So this, what we're looking at, is not just history. We are shown a plan for how God is going to continue to work through the Jewish people. Mm. That the covenant is only given to those who demonstrate their faith in God, not only by saying, I love God. There are some Jews who will say, yeah, I don't keep this and this, but I'm a good Jew in my heart. We call them cardiac Jews. But that, no, it has to, it can't do that. There are Jews who are called Orthodox, but they behave terribly. That's not good.
So in Christianity, they're called Christers, right? Because they turn up on Christmas and they turn up on Easter, and that was all. You know, twice a year I do that and it's good. It's a cultural Christianity. And I suppose in the same way, of course, in Judaism, we have cultural Jews, but they're not necessarily observant Jews. They just say a little bit of this, a little bit, because I'm Jewish and I want to be culturally part of my people, right?
Right. But, you know, the difference is that Christianity is a religion of creed. It's just what you believe. The Judaism is not just a faith, but it's also a nation. It's a family, mm-hmm. and the family is preserved. There is no Christian that's ever said in history, my great-great-grandmother or my great-grandmother saw Jesus feeding thousands of people with fish, or saw Jesus walk on water. There was never such a claim. Neither is a very interesting thing. Neither is there anywhere in the Christian canon that says you should follow what your Christian parents said, follow what your father said. We don't have that anywhere in the New Testament. But in the Jewish Bible, we're constantly admonished that if someone comes to you and tells you something that your fathers didn't know, don't follow him. Do you have a question about the God of Israel? Sha'al avicha, ask your father, he'll tell you, zikkeinecho, your elders, they'll tell you all about it. Mm-hmm. So what we have is a Mesorah. That's where you have the Masoretic text, that same kind of word, where you have a nation that's giving over. And that's another commandment of Passover. It means this is a family that witnessed it. It was a national event. It's not take my word for it. It was a virgin birth. No one could have seen that. This is a national event, and therefore, listen to your dad. He's going to convey it over to you. Magid. Mm-hmm. He's going to tell over. And if your children will ask you, you'll tell them. It's going to become a very important part in scripture of a feature of Passover, and that is the telling of the father to the son. Continue that, because it happened to an entire people, entire
That's
nation.
Right.
But you know, there's another fascinating angle to all of this, which I think that most people are unaware of. You know, the New Testament teaches that when Jesus died on the cross, there would no longer be any need for a sacrificial system. He died once and for all. In fact, Paul, in the book of Romans in chapter 6, says very explicitly that the death he died to sin once and for all. The Greek word there is epipax, which means it's a Greek adverb, but it denotes once only, meaning that it's never to be done again. This idea is repeated again in the book of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 10. Regardless who wrote it, it's part of the Christian canon, and it's central to this theme. In Hebrews chapter 10, verse 10, and again verse 18, the author says that that which has been holy, being made holy through the body of Jesus Christ, has been done once and for all, and there's no longer any need for a sacrifice. Naturally, that raises a staggering question, because when you look at the unused ancient Jewish floor plans for the third and final temple in the end of the book of Ezekiel, the prophet makes it very clear that, in fact, the sacrificial system is returning. The prophet goes through great length to articulate and express the sacrifice that will be returning. But it gets even more interesting than this. Ezekiel tells us that it would be the Messiah himself who would be bringing these sacrifices. You can go to in Ezekiel 45:22. The prophet brings into view that the prince is the Messiah. He's going to offer a bull for a sin offering for himself and on behalf of the nation. Why would he need to do that? In Ezekiel 45, and you could just go from 45 verse 19 to the end of the chapter, it tells us that in fact the Messiah would be bringing a lamb offering, a Passover offering, and you'll see that stated in the next chapter in Ezekiel 46 verse 4. Why would Jesus need to bring a lamb offering if he is the lamb? That's a very important question. In fact, if you go a little later, just 10 verses later, Ezekiel tells us that the prince is going to have a family and children. That, of course, doesn't fit the Christian model. And it's not a memorial. Some Christians might say, well, maybe this is a memorial, a retroactive memorial to what was in the past. But you'll see that's not the case. In Ezekiel 45, verse 20, 21 to 2, it says there that the sin offering is bought for sins that are committed unintentionally at the time. There's no memorial going on here. So naturally, if John is to advance the idea, and only John does this of the four Gospels, that Jesus was the Passover lamb, why would he be bringing a Passover lamb? Why would he be bringing a sin offering? The Passover lamb, as we stated, has nothing to do with sin, but the sin sacrifice does. Why would a perfect, unblemished, sinless Messiah be bringing a sin offering on behalf of himself? I encourage the listeners to open their Bible for themselves and read it for themselves. It's there. All of this coming together, when we have the picture of what's going to happen at the end of days, we have to conclude that, in fact, the Passover sacrifice is returning, sin offering is returning. And the question is, why would a Messiah, if it's Jesus, why would he be bringing a Passover lamb on behalf of himself?
That's right. Excellent. And I think that's a good place to leave it. Jason, did you want to add anything at all?
I just wanted to wish everyone that's going to celebrate Passover in their own way, even if it's just remembering the amazing work that our Creator did in bringing his chosen people Israel out of Egypt. Fantastic, blessed, and relaxing Passover.
Have a wonderful Pesach, everybody. And thank you, Tobias Singer. OutreachJudaism.org is his website, OutreachJudaism.org. Thank you once again for coming back on the program, my friend.
Hey, great to be with you guys.
Back into the water with you. And until next time, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.